before you brought you forth. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. We have a little sister. There's a change in speaker now. It is the brothers of the Shulamite. We have a little sister, and she has no breast. What shall we do for our sister in the day for when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver, and if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Well, then the Shulamite responds, I am a wall, and my breast like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased his vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. My own vineyard, it is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend its fruit, 200. And then the final two verses. First, Solomon speaks. You who dwell in the gardens, the companions listen for your voice, but let me hear it. Final verse, the words of the Shulamite woman. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains, or the mountains of spices. Love really is a wonderful thing, but love can also be a dangerous thing, and in some instances, love can even be a confusing thing. In fact, it is often the case that those who think they are in love sometimes confuse love with infatuation. Now, this is not what you have at the end of the handout this evening, but I did come across several years ago an article that I think does a very fine job of helping us see the difference or the contrast between real love and infatuation. And it says this, infatuation leaps into bloom. Love usually takes root and grows one day at a time. Infatuation is accompanied by a sense of uncertainty. You are stimulated and thrilled, but not really happy. You are miserable when he is absent. You can't wait until you see her again. Love begins with a feeling of security. You are warm with a sense of his nearness even when he is away. Miles do not separate you. You want her near, but near or far, you know she is yours and you can wait. Infatuation says, we must get married right away. I can't risk losing him. Love says, don't rush into anything. You are sure of one another. You can plan your future with confidence. Infatuation, it has an element of sexual excitement. If you are honest, you will discover it is difficult to enjoy one another unless you will know it will end in intimacy. Love, on the other hand, is the maturation of friendship. And here is a great statement. You must and should be friends before you become lovers. Infatuation lacks confidence. When he's away, you wonder, is he with another girl? When she is away, you wonder, is she with another guy? Sometimes you even check. Love means trust. You may fall into infatuation, but you never fall in love. Infatuation might lead you to do things for which you might be sorry, but love never will. Love lifts you up. Love makes you look up. Love makes you think up. It makes you a better person than you were before. Song of Solomon believes that love is such an important subject that it is the concluding theme of the book. And in these verses before us, no less than 12 different aspects of biblical love, especially as it exists between a man and a woman in marriage, is described for us here in these verses. Let's walk through them together quickly. Number one, love is a public thing. Chapter 8, verse 5. Who is this that is coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Evidently, Shulamith is with Solomon, and again, they are riding in the royal chariot. Her very posture speaks of the fact that she is secure and that she is relaxed. She is leaning upon her beloved. I point out, first of all, that whoever is speaking, and we're not sure of those who are speaking, this is something that is public. This is not something that's hidden or behind closed doors, but rather her love for Solomon and Solomon's love for her is put on public display for everyone to see. Some Bible teachers believe the idea of coming up from the wilderness may have behind it the idea of them coming through wilderness-type experiences in their marriage. After all, the children of Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness, and so this may be one way of saying those wilderness experiences, those difficult, tough times in our marriage are now behind us. Others have pointed out that the idea of the wilderness sometimes in the Bible speaks of cursedness, and yet what is being said here is this. This is no cursed relationship, but rather it is a redeemed relationship. Yes, Genesis chapter 3 tells us that because of sin, the relationship between a man and a woman is disrupted. The battle of the sexes did indeed begin in the Garden of Eden. Yet through Jesus Christ, we can have a redeemed relationship, and I believe that's what you have portrayed for you here. The effects of the curse have been set aside. Theirs is a healthy relationship. Theirs is a secure relationship. Theirs is a redeemed relationship. And the neat thing about it is public. They have a relationship that other people see, take notice. And I want to say to you, as those who claim to follow Jesus Christ, our marriages ought to be of such a nature that indeed they can be and are a testimony to people who watch and to people who observe. Our relationship indeed should be something that all the world should see and all the world should learn from. Theirs was a public love. Secondly, their love is also private. For she says there in verse 5, now the Shulamite woman speaks, I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. I believe it is the Shulamite woman speaking because the I is in the feminine gender. And again, we see her taking the lead in initiating lovemaking with her husband. Evidently, they've left the chariot. Evidently, they have now gone aside and are alone. I think it is interesting to note that the apple tree back in chapter 2 and verse 3 was something that she called her beloved. And so it may be that, again, the idea of the apple tree, and in the ancient world it did have a sensual and romantic connotation, it may again have that meaning here. I awakened you under the apple tree. And so there's a sensual, sexual innuendo here. There, your mother brought you forth. In other words, his mother, likewise had been in an intimate relationship with his daddy, and as a result of their love relationship, as a result of their sex life, as a result of their coming together, they had produced Solomon. And now in the same way, the Shulamite woman and Solomon come together, and like a lovely, beautiful apple tree that has beautiful, desirous fruit, she indeed refers to her husband in that kind of a way. Under the apple tree, I awakened you there. And so she indeed initiates love. She initiates romance. Again, we find that their love has this, beautiful complementary nature. It's public for all the world to see on one hand, and on the other hand, it is very private. It is very intimate. It is very sensual. It is very satisfying. Their intimate life is something that each of them find tasteful, satisfying, and meaningful. Their love is also a private matter. Number 3, their love is also a personal matter. Verse 6, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. In the ancient world, a person's seal was extremely important and personal. In one sense, it would indicate ownership, and it was something that they would place upon their most valued possessions. So what is being said here? Shulamite is saying to Solomon, I want the world to know, and I want to know that I am indeed one of your, if not your most valued possession. Set me as a seal where? Upon your heart, the most intimate and private place of your emotions and your affections. It is interesting to note that in the ancient world, many times a person would wear their seal like a cylinder piece of jewelry around their neck. And so if the necklace was around the neck and the cylinder was hanging down, it would hang where? Near to their heart, in the middle of their chest. And so she is saying, just like that precious seal is near to your heart, so I likewise want to be in that kind of precious, devoted, committed place in your life as well. Now, I want to raise a question. What are some of the ways that we can demonstrate this type of commitment, this type of personal affection and love for our mate? Well, the issue, I think, is one of intimacy. And so if you'll take the notes that you have this evening for just a moment, over on about the third page, you'll see something that I call the marital intimacy test. I'm not asking you to take it tonight, but it would be good for you sometime today or tomorrow with your mate to sit down and just simply walk through these 10 questions and let each of you answer them. And we all remember when we were in school. Some of us are still in school, so we'll operate on a 4-point scale. But just look at some of the questions that you find here. How often do you show affection for each other? Number two, how often do you laugh at each other's jokes? I've seen some couples that I doubt have laughed at or with one another in decades, and it shows. How often do you say something nice to each other? How often do you compliment your partner in front of others? How often do you enjoy sexual intimacy? How often are you playful with each other? How often do you look each other in the eyes while talking? That's a great question. How often do you give each other a little surprise? How often do you say, please? And how often do you say, I'm sorry? I do believe that those are 10 good questions that would be well for all of us to take as an examination. And indeed, as we move in the positive direction of often or often enough, I believe we will increase indeed the aspect of love that is indeed personal. Now, number four, love is also protective. Look at what he says there in verse 6, or what Shulamite says. Not only do you set me as a seal upon your heart, but also set me as a seal, where? Upon your arm. Of course, the arm is a sign of strength. And so she is saying, I also want to be very near to that place of strength, that place of security, that place of rest, and that place of safety. We have talked about this before, but let's be reminded again. True love always has a protective attitude. You desire to shield the one you love from anything that is harmful, hurtful, and detrimental to their person and to your relationship. But let me just give one example and we'll move on. I doubt there is a more effective, lethal weapon in marriage relationships than the public criticism and sarcastic barbs that some people throw at their mate in front of other people. I doubt anything is more hurtful to their personhood. I doubt anything is more embarrassing. Indeed, I don't want to chase this too far, but in the first church that I served, there was a couple that after many, many years of marriage separated and divorced. The husband had been the chairman of the deacons. He had been the head of the Sunday school. If you had asked virtually anybody in that church who is the most godly man in that church, they would have pointed at this man. But he walked away from his marriage after almost 20 years. Later, as I was talking to some of the other men, they said something that I don't agree with, but I do understand to some degree. They were, in essence, kind of defending the fact that he had walked away. And then one of them, when they saw my displeasure with what they were saying, at least put it in this way. I agree, it is wrong, and he is not right for doing what he did, but I do understand. Well, I was very young at the time, about 21 or 22, and I said, well, I don't understand at all. And they said, this particular man, I'm not saying it's right, but Danny, if you ever spent any time with them at all, you would at least understand a little bit why he did what he did. And I said, what are you talking about? He went on to say, I can never remember a time when we went out to eat or when we were at a public gathering with them that she was not constantly, just moment by moment by moment by moment, putting him down, criticizing him. If he would answer a question, she would have to correct him. If he had the right answer, she would have to give a more right answer. And finally, I guess it got to a point where he just couldn't take it anymore. Now, I'm not justifying what he did. I'm just simply saying to you that it is one of the most lethal weapons that unfortunately enters into far too many relationships. And real, genuine love for our mate will always have a protective attitude. Number five, it will also be possessive. Look at what you see there. Not only is love to be as a seal upon the heart, not only is love to be a seal upon the arm, but now the Bible says love is what? Love is as strong as death. Love is as strong as death, and jealousy as cruel as the grave. In other words, there is indeed a possessive aspect to our love that says, just like death will not let go, so it is that love likewise will not let go as well. It is universal, just like death. It is unavoidable, just like death. The word strong here, it is the only time this word occurs in the Song of Solomon. It means an irresistible assailant, an immovable defender. You're not going to be able to get away from it. And what is he saying? He is saying when God brings a man and a woman together, and that man and woman grow in their relationship as God designed and as God intended, their love will be so unbreakable. Their love will be so immovable. Their love will be so sure and certain. It will be just as certain as death is for every single one of us. Now he goes on to say there something interesting. Love is jealous as cruel as the grave. Now we need to do a little thinking here. Most of the time when we use the word jealous or jealousy, we use it in a negative way, but it is not meant in that way here. The word jealousy indeed may not be the best translation, because all he is talking about is a very strong, zealous passion. I guess the best way to say it is similar to what you find in James chapter 4, where the Bible says God is what? Jealous for us. God is not willing to share us with anyone. The Bible is saying that in a true love relationship, you find this same type of passion, this same type of jealousy for the presence and the protection and the partnership of your mate. And just like jealousy being cruel as the grave, just like the grave swallows men and women down once it has laid hold of them, so it is that love likewise, a godly love, is inevitable. It will not let go of the one it loves. When I was in high school, I played all the sports, and I remember when I played football, over our locker room door, there was this saying that went something like this: when the going gets tough, the tough keep or get going. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. It probably is, but this one thing I do know. When the going gets tough, love keeps going. Love will not throw in the towel. Love will not drop out of the race. Love will not throw its hands up and quit and walk away. It will not do so. Why? Because love is possessive. It is as strong as death, and it is as cruel or certain as the grave. But then he also says love is powerful. Look at the last phrase of verse 6. It's flames, are flames of fire and a most vehement flame. If you have an NIV Bible, it says love burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. In other words, the emphasis falls upon the power and the intensity of this love. Now let me point something out for you. We've already noted in our study that the name of God is never mentioned in the Song of Solomon. The best that we have come up with, and I think rightly so, is that back in chapter 4, when they are enjoying their wedding night, God steps in as the unseen guest, and in chapter 5, the latter part of verse 1, it is not the wind, it is not the Jerusalem daughters, it is not some friend, but it is God who says, "Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones." And I believe that that is a reference to God. But here's what is interesting. It is possible that the divine name is hidden in this verse, because where it says, "Its flames are a flame of fire, a most vehement flame," you actually have a shortened poetic version of Yahweh, maybe, in that verse. And so as a result of that, some people have pointed out that what is being said here is that the love that we experience in marriage is a flame of fire that has its very source in God Himself. So if God is indeed the source of the flame of our love, then it is a good thing, a godly thing, a heavenly thing, a right thing, and something that indeed should last and endure till death do us part. So he says here that love is indeed a powerful thing. Now, I have another question. How is it that we can ensure that this love that we have continues in its powerful way? How can we be sure that this love will indeed last until death, that it will have this nature of being a fire of flame? Well, again, look on that page where you had the intimacy test. And right below it, I just raised something along the lines of a few true-false questions that we ought to consider from time to time as far as how are we doing in growing in the knowledge of our mate. So, for example, true or false? I can name my partner's best friend. I know what stresses that my partner currently faces. I know the name of those who have been irritating my partner lately. That's an interesting question. I know some of my partner's life dreams. I am familiar with my partner's spiritual beliefs, their basic philosophy of life. I can list the relatives my partner likes least. Again, I don't know who came up with these questions, but I find them rather entertaining. I know my partner's favorite music, and my wife is totally depraved here. She likes country music. Number 9, I can list my partner's favorite 3 movies. For Charlotte, it's the last 3 movies she saw. Number 10, in all seriousness, if I want to just, you know, this is just Danny Aiken letting you know a little bit about our lives. If I want to, you know, rack up big points with Charlotte, I just take her to a movie. The idea, it doesn't matter where, it really doesn't matter what. My wife is a movie fanatic. Now, she loves the old movies, the old black and white movies, but she loves for me to take her to the movies. And so it doesn't really matter. She likes all of them. So if I just begin to name some, I'll probably hit close to the right ones because she is just geared and wired that way. Well, I know the most stressful thing that happened to my partner in their childhood. Well, that's a great question. You know, do you know that? I don't know that I had anything really stressful, but I know that for Charlotte, it was the divorce of her parents and her being placed in a children's home. And that would be stressful, and that would be traumatic, and that would be life-changing for anyone. And as I thought about it over the 20-plus years that we've been married now, I can see some of the good and some of the pain that came out of that particular time in her life, even today, as my wife of 22 years. I can list my partner's major aspirations. I know what my partner would do if he or she suddenly received $10 million. If they were spiritual, they'd give it to you, wouldn't they? I know, okay? Number 13, I can relate in detail my first impressions of my partner. And I could do that for you tonight, but I won't because it would embarrass my wife. But I thought she looked awful good. Number 14, I asked my partner about his or her world periodically. And I feel my partner knows me well. I assure you, if we can move in positive ways to answer those questions, our love will indeed grow in its protective, possessive, and powerful nature. Number 7, love is persevering. Love is persevering. Verse 7, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. I came across an article that is rather sad and tragic, but it gives the antithesis of what God is holding up before us this evening as his design. The title of the article is, "And You Wonder Why It Didn't Last." She married him because he was such a strong man. She divorced him because he was such a dominating male. He married her because she was so fragile and petite. He divorced her because she was so weak and helpless. She married him because he knows how to provide a good living. She divorced him because all he thinks about is business. He married her because she reminds me of my mother. He divorced her because she's getting more like her mother every day. She married him because he was happy and romantic. But she divorced him because he was shiftless and fun-loving and irresponsible. He married her because she was steady and sensible. He divorced her because she was boring and dull. She married him because he was the life of the party. She divorced him because he never wants to come home from the party. Folks, God meant for marriage to last, and God meant for love to last. It is not for a season, but it is for a lifetime. And Solomon says here, when we nurture our love, When we give attention to our love, when we allow God to work in our marriage so that our love becomes what He designed it to become, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it out. It is going to last. It is going to continue. There is nothing you can do. It has a persevering character. Number eight, it also is viewed as priceless. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, what? It would be utterly despised. What is he saying? Just simply this: true love can't be bought. True love has no price tag. It is not for sale. If you were to give all that you own and try to buy love, the Bible says you would be despised and scorned. You would be publicly ridiculed and mocked. By its very nature, love must be given. It absolutely cannot be bought. Love is priceless. Number nine, love is also pure. Look with me now at verse 8 and also verse 9. Let me first interject. Verses 8 through 12 probably are best understood as a flashback to Shulamite's childhood and youth, and then her initial meeting with Solomon. We already know from chapter 1, verse 6, that she grew up in a home where most likely her daddy had died, because she never mentions her father. He's never mentioned in the book. Her mother is mentioned, and her brothers are mentioned. Now, we know from chapter 1, verse 6, that sometimes her brothers were hard on her. Sometimes they made life difficult for her, and they pushed her, of course, out into the fields and made her work alongside of them. And as she said in chapter 1, it caused her to have to neglect her own garden, her body, because of the harshness and the anger of her brothers. Well, here, her brothers are at least placed in a bit more positive light because of their interest in their sister. And in particular, they are interested in her moral development and her moral character. And what we learn here is that real love is pure. Look at it there with me, verse 8. Her brothers are speaking. We have a little sister. And I believe it is referring to her childhood, because they said, as a little sister, she had no breast. She is an adolescent. She has not developed and matured yet as a woman. So then they raised the question, what shall we do for our sister in light of the day when she is spoken for? In other words, if we're going to be good family, what will we do for our little sister to ensure that when it comes the time for her to marry, she will be prepared in every way? Well, they say, in one sense, that is going to depend upon her. What do they say there? Well, if she is a wall, symbolic of her putting up barriers. If she is a wall and she has barriers so that she is saving herself sexually for marriage, if she is a wall, then we will honor her. We will build upon her a battlement of silver, and we will honor her. On the other hand, if she is a door swinging open to men, any man, certain men who come along, if she is sexually promiscuous and shows poor judgment, then what will we do? Well, we will take steps to enclose her, and we will do so with boards of cedar. In other words, Shulamite had a family, and we learn a very valuable lesson here. She had a family that indeed took a personal interest in her moral character and her sexual development. In other words, they were committed to the proposition that she would indeed save herself for the day of her wedding, that she would come into her marriage as a virgin. Now, I want to ask all of us this evening, how many of us are doing what we ought to be doing in the lives of our children and, if necessary, our grandchildren, to ensure that they understand that it is indeed a good thing, a right thing, a God thing to save themselves sexually for marriage? How many of you are working with your kids like we see here, so that if they are acting in a way that is responsible, you honor them, you praise them, you extol them? And if you've got a child that doesn't have good sense, you have a child that doesn't show good judgment, then you draw the barriers and you draw the parameters in. And you let them know, I'm not doing this to cramp your style or to rain on your parade or to ruin your fun. I love you too much to see you act the fool. I love you too much to see you make a mistake that could scar you for the rest of your life. Now, folks, that's serious business. And tragically, many times we rather just kind of, you know, close our eyes and pretend nothing's happening and then pay the price later. No, love is to be pure. And in real love, a person will indeed save themselves for that one person and that one person alone who has a right to their body. Well, what do we discover about Shulamith? We discover two things. Number 10, love is peaceful. She did this. She indeed now responds. I don't think she's angry, but there's a rather direct response. Is there not in verse 10? It's as if she is listening to her brother's talk, and she says, you just hush a minute. Let me tell you what I did. I am a wall. I did save myself. I was a virgin when I got married. I kept myself pure for the day of my marriage and my wedding. Now, as a grown woman, my breasts are like towers. And I became in his eyes, whose eyes? Her husband's eyes. I became in his eyes as one who found peace. In other words, she says, I am now a vibrant, sensual, mature woman of God. I have kept myself, I saved myself, and as a result of that, my husband finds in me not turmoil, but peace. He is at rest, he is secure, he is confident in my relationship with him because he knows I saved myself for him. Therefore, love has a peaceful component as well. Number 11, love is also privileged. Look with me there at verse 11 and verse 12. Let me read the verses and then kind of come back and explain it. She uses an analogy. Solomon has a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leases the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. My own vineyard, though, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend its fruit, 200. Now you say, what is all that saying? It's saying this. Solomon owned everything. Solomon was rich. Solomon was wealthy. Solomon basically could buy anything he wanted. So, for example, he had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased it to farmers. They tended the ground, and basically Solomon was getting a 5-for-1 return. You saw it. You're to bring 1,000, you get to keep 200. Okay? Pretty good deal. For every 1,000 that's made, they kept 200. Solomon got the rest, a 5-to-1 ratio, a very good business deal, one that evidently the farmers entered into willingly. It was good for them. It was good for Solomon. Her point is this. Yes, Solomon, you can will and deal in that kind of a way with the things you own, but you don't own me. You didn't own me. You don't own me. What I give freely. I give willingly. Now look at it in that context. Solomon has a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. But my own vineyard is where? It is before me. In other words, she is saying, it is a privilege that I give myself to you. You don't own me. You didn't buy me. You can't pay for me. What I give, remember, love cannot be bought. Love must be given. And so she says, by my free will, I give myself to you as an act not of purchase, but as an act of love. Number 12, love is also particular. I find it interesting that the last two verses of the book allow both the man and the woman to speak. Now, guys, are you surprised who gets the last word? It is the Shulamite woman in verse 14. I don't want to make too much of that. But Solomon speaks first, and then the Shulamite woman speaks in verse 14. He says, you who dwell in the gardens, in the place of rest, and in the place, perhaps, of sensual activity in our marriage, the companions, they listen for your voice. In other words, this is a lady that is admired not just by her husband, but by many. And so there are others that would like to hear her, like to see her, like to enjoy her presence. But Solomon says, no, let me hear your voice. They may want you, but you're mine. They may long to see you, But you now belong to me in this wonderful, holy relationship of marriage. There is indeed a marvelous particularity to our love and to our marriage. Well, she knows that lots of folks would like to see her. Lots of folks would like to talk with her. She also knows her man would also like to be with her. So how does she respond in verse 14? She ignores the companion. Verse 14, she speaks to the one. Make haste, literally hurry up, my beloved. What would you have me to do, my sweet wife? Oh, be like a gazelle or be like the young stag on the mountain of spices. And again, I think you have a very subtle but very clear reference again to her breast. She has already referred to them earlier as the mountain of myrrh and the mountain of frankincense. And now she says, you come and you enjoy the mountains of spices. You be my beloved like a young virile gazelle, like that young stag, and understand that I am indeed here and I am here waiting for you. Now, as we close tonight, I want to show you something that I've included in the handout this evening that I hope that you will look at and that you will also give good attention to and hopefully take to heart. In the next to last page, you'll see something that says at the top, our marriage covenant. I am hopeful that at the next Southern Baptist Convention, I've been given the privilege of serving on a committee that was formed last year on marriage and on the family. And it is my hope that at the next Southern Baptist Convention, just like we have a Sanctity of Life Day and some other days throughout the year where we recognize particular things, I am hoping, and I know that there are several that are going to present as a proposal that Southern Baptists put on their calendar as an annual observance right in the middle of Mother's Day and Father's Day, Marriage Day, a day where we honor marriage. Furthermore, I know that a number are already doing this. They've established their own marriage day, and here's what they're doing. Many of my friends are now having a marriage Sunday where they let folks know in advance that when you come to church this Sunday, we're going to give you the opportunity and the privilege of renewing your vows to your spouse in a public ceremony as part of our morning worship. And a number of them are also, as people are coming to those things, giving them this thing here, which was originally thought up by Dennis Rainey and Family Life Ministries, which is a marriage covenant that is a further declaration of their commitment to their marriage for life. I want you to listen to what it says, and we'll read the words together as our close this evening. Believing that God, in His wisdom and providence, has established marriage as a covenant relationship, a sacred and lifelong promise, reflecting our unconditional love for one another, and believing that God intends for the marriage covenant to reflect His promise to never leave us nor to forsake us, we, the undersigned, do hereby reaffirm our solemn pledge to fulfill our marriage vows. Furthermore, we pledge to exalt the sacred nature and permanence of the marriage covenant by calling others to honor and fulfill their marriage vows. And then what they invite the husband and the wife to do, and I just think it's absolutely beautiful. In the presence of God and these witnesses and by a holy covenant, I, Daniel L. Aiken, joyfully receive you as God's perfect gift for me to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, to love you, to honor you, to cherish you, and to protect you, forsaking all others, as long as we both shall live. In the presence of God and these witnesses, and by a holy covenant, I, Charlotte Aiken, joyfully receive you as God's perfect gift for me, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love you, to honor you, to cherish you, and to protect you, forsaking all others, as long as we both shall live. And then here's what happens. The husband signs, the wife signs, and then there's a place also for additional witnesses. And in many of these marriages, in many of these services, those who bear witness are the children. And as a wonderful statement to their children, as a wonderful statement to their mom and dad, it is their children who then append their names as witness to the sacred commitment and covenant of renewal that this man and this woman has made with one another. I don't know where all that will go, and I'm not the pastor of this church. I'll follow our pastor wherever he wants us to go. But I can say this to you. I think it would be a wonderful thing that sometime in the future here at Highview Baptist Church, we would see at a worship service hundreds of us standing, renewing our vows, renewing our commitment to our mate in our marriage covenant, and then having our precious children, regardless of what age they are, and in fact, the younger probably the more precious, for them to be able to sign and scribble on their little name, understanding that today Mama has said to Daddy, I'll never leave you. And Daddy has said to Mama, I'll never leave you. And to those precious gifts that God has given us, we have said to them, and we together will always be here for you. I assure you, nothing would honor God more and nothing would bless our children more when it comes to us then saying, that is the kind of marriage, and that is the kind of family, indeed, we're going to trust God to give us. Would you close your eyes with me and let us close in a word of prayer? Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for this study that has now come to an end in the Song of Solomon. In many ways, I regret that, because it has been a wonderful 4 or 5 months as we have walked verse by verse through this book, looked at it biblically and theologically, but also very practically as we have thought, how is it that we can flesh out some of the truth that we find here in our own marriage relationship? And Lord, it is my prayer that as a result of our journey together, my marriage included, that we have strengthened our marriages, strengthened our commitment to one another. And Lord, I realize that nobody in here tonight has a perfect marriage. But some folks here have a great marriage. Some folks have a good marriage. And Lord, some folks may have kind of a mediocre or even a struggling marriage. But Lord, I know this. You will take us wherever we are, and if we will put our eyes on you, renew our devotion to the Lordship of Jesus Christ and to one another, we can begin to walk in a direction that can heal hurt, that can bring joy, and that can indeed raise our marriage to a new level, one perhaps it has never, ever seen before. Lord, I've seen you do that many, many, many times. And Lord, I would ask and pray that you would do it again. So Lord, take us where we are. Take us to greater heights than we've ever known before, that indeed you would receive the glory and us the blessing. This we ask and pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Next Wednesday night, we will begin our study, The Great Unveiling, the Book of Revelation. I'll see you then.